Just to make sure we keep things very current and pertinent, I thought I'd read a few paragraphs from an October 2013 book review out of Christianity Today. The Sacredness of Human Life, in which ethicist David Gushee recounts the history of Christian pro-life thinking and our failure to live up with it, live up to it. Here's the linchpin of his argument. By the way, this is David Neff writing. The sacredness of human life as portrayed in the Bible and the Church Fathers is not anchored in any particular human quality. Philosophers have tried to locate our human essence in various things, from our ability to reason to our capacity for relationship. But in biblical thinking, humans are sacred only because the Creator, Redeemer, God ascribes such worth to them. This theocentric view is vital because infants, those with mental disabilities, and many elderly lack key capacities, yet are still of ultimate worth to God. How did the church lose its radical commitment to life? One key factor, Gushee writes, was that the apocalyptic framework of Jesus' teaching faded. Jesus promised to come back soon to establish his kingdom, but centuries passed, the Christian population grew, and the kingdom of God became associated with a church endowed with state power and a state blessed by church leaders. Belief in the sacred worth of all people does not serve the interests of power. War shifted from a necessary evil to a divine command. Quote, "The Christian glories in the death of the pagan," wrote medieval mystic Bernard of Clairvaux, "because Christ is glorified." End quote. Nevertheless, some witnessed against this theological glorification of violence. Francis of Assisi, for example, worked against the barbarity of the Crusades, and Bartolome de las Casas condemned the cruelties of the Spanish colonialism. I'm going to skip here. Schaeffer worried that Gorman was pushing some form of pacifism. Gushee refuses to enter the pacifist versus just war debate. Instead, he advocates just peacemaking initiatives, strenuous efforts toward nonviolent conflict resolution that can honor just war theory's commitment to making war a last resort. If Christians of all stripes put peace-building efforts first, we can help strip war of its religious justifications and cloak human life with the sacredness it warrants. Sociologist Rodney Stark has argued that early Christianity brought a new conception of humanity to a world saturated with capricious cruelty and the vicarious love of death. He attributes much of the church's remarkable growth to the fact that it, quote, gave to its converts nothing less than their humanity. And then Neff concludes, a consistent pro-life ethic, by honoring what God honors, makes a powerful witness. An interesting book review from Christianity Today. The book, again, is called The Sacredness of Human Life. The author, David Gushee. The reviewer, David Neff. Today, I'd like to get into a consideration of one side of the spectrum, specifically the pacifist viewpoint. We've talked in past weeks about how we might construe the positions regarding war on a continuum, and we might have over on the leftmost end the pacifist perspective, and then we might have on the rightmost end something that it might depend on what we call it there. We might say a holy war ethic, especially if we're talking about a Christian context. We might say a total war ethic. Frequently in the political realm, it's called a realist perspective. And then in the middle, trying to balance between those two extremes, we might find the just war theorist. And we might move ourselves, if we're trying to position ourselves on this line, we might try to adjust ourselves right or left a little bit by using the terms hawkish or dovish to sort of say, well, I'm a just war theorist, but I'm a little on the hawkish end because I think there's bad people out there and we need to give them their comeuppance. Or we might say, I'm a bit of a hawkish pacifist. I really like the idea of pacifism, but when it really comes down to it, I'm willing to intervene to, or I would laud certain wars of the 20th century. So you might think in those terms, and it's probably a good exercise for any and all of us to try to position ourselves mentally on the map, right? And determine where would I be. I know, for example, I've talked with Ken Foyt about how in his personal history he was at one time a pacifist. He would no longer call himself a pacifist completely, maybe, or maybe...
I would again.
Oh, okay. My mistake. Others... Others I know maybe have come from a total war perspective and have drifted to the left toward some other form of just war theory. So I think in any case, serious moral reflection often ends up pushing us around a little bit, and it might be the case that as we discuss things, there's new considerations that might inform where you place yourself on a spectrum. In any case, you know, in the interest of intellectual integrity and in the interest of acknowledging a major branch of the tradition in Christianity, it's worth our while to spend a week or two talking about the pacifist tradition and checking out its credentials, the historical perspective, and then also the more recent developments of it. I know that as a young person, I had nothing but contempt, and I was very dismissive of a pacifist perspective. I told you a little bit about my intellectual history with respect to war last time, and so that's not surprising considering where I came from. But I think it's worth pointing out that we do have not a single pacifist position, but a number of different pacifisms that you might describe. I've already recommended this book, But Was It Just? This is the one that costs a penny used on Amazon, plus $3.99 shipping typically. But another book that I've been working through in my own studies is this book by Mark Allman, A-L-L-M-A-N. And I was really turned off by the title. Perhaps you will be too. The title is, Who Would Jesus Kill? And I mentioned to my friend that I was impressed with the usefulness of this book. And I said, you know, the title is what is annoying me. It's called Who Would Jesus Kill? But it's really a textbook for a college-level class on issues of war and peace. And he said, well, that's funny. You would think that it would have a better title than that. That just sounds like a pacifist screed, was my friend's comment. And I think maybe that's right. I wish the title were different. I guess I can understand what he's doing. And he talks a little bit about his title. He's trying to be provocative. I think probably succeeds on that score. I think he's trying to challenge and shake the potential reader out of a dogmatic slumber, maybe. And I think that's fair enough, too. I think we probably do need to hear challenges and address ourselves to them. I wonder, though, just theologically, we might answer all sorts of things. Clearly, it's primarily a rhetorical question, but we could take the question at face value, too, couldn't we? And we could say, well, who would Jesus kill if Jesus is understood to be Jehovah, right? And then we scan back through the Old Testament, then things get pretty complicated. You know, in Jude 5, we have the identification of Jesus as Jehovah, who, you know, is using the armies of the world to accomplish his will, including the death of many people. But then that's not precisely what we mean when we're talking about Jesus. We're talking about the God-man who came with a specific intention, with a specific mission, and his mission included shunning earthly power. And, you know, that's part of the reason why it's a bit, you know, I don't know how you feel about the question of what would Jesus do. This is clearly a takeoff on that sort of modern quip. Well, what would Jesus do? And I don't really find that to be a very helpful question for Christian ethics. Do you? I mean, whatever Jesus would have done, I'm miles away from it already. And before the afternoon is up, I'm going to be several more million miles away, right? I'm not a sinless creature. Jesus was. I don't have a mission to redeem humanity through an obedient life and a death and resurrection. But Jesus did. I don't have the foggiest notion what Jesus would do in most respects, right? And I'm pretty sure that that's not a very ethically robust question for the Christian to ask, right? And so I feel, in one sense, the title of the book may be sort of cheap or shallow in that sense, because Jesus was purposely shunning earthly power, as Rob was again mentioning this morning. You know, not at all what the Jews expected. They were expecting earthly power. And so I think it's complicated, even his rhetorical question. Jim, did you have a...
Well, I think it would help to understand what the author is getting at if you knew whether he was a Christian or not.
Oh, okay, yeah, good, thank you. The author is one of the leading Catholic voices. He teaches at Merrimack. Right. Right. So the title of the book, Who Would Jesus Kill?, is intentionally provocative. When faced with this question as a Catholic Christian, I want to immediately cry out, no one. Jesus would have nothing to do with violence and killing. But then why are so many men and women in our armed forces Christian? Why do we have chaplains serving in the military? How is it that a predominantly Christian nation is also the world's superpower and the only nation to ever resort to nuclear warfare? If it's so obvious that Jesus wouldn't kill anyone, then why are Christians responsible for so much killing? So, in fact, Allman is not a pacifist, and what he's doing in this textbook is what I think we should all do, and that is lay out the whole spectrum and examine it piece by piece and look at the depth of the moral arguments from each perspective on their own terms, and do our best to dialogue with those perspectives.
The fact that he's a Catholic university professor doesn't rule out the possibility that he's trying to poke Jesus in the eye.
Okay.
Based on my knowledge of Catholic university professors, it raises the probability immensely. I actually would love to get a bumper sticker. If anybody makes these and starts selling them, I will buy a dozen bumper stickers that say, "Who would Jesus abort?"
Okay, yeah. Right, so he doesn't back off immediately where I stopped reading. He simply leaves the question hanging, saying, well, look, obviously a lot of Christians answer this question in different ways, and some of them include a perspective that's in just war or whatever. So he's more complicated. He doesn't explicitly acknowledge that Jesus had a special mission during his 3 years of public ministry. But I think what we can take from what he's actually done is that he's determined to give us, on their own terms, an account of sort of the three poles of the spectrum. And so I'm willing to forgive him of his title, I guess. Yeah, I might. That's a good point. The grammar is... Yeah. So I'll frequently be referring to this book, I think, in the coming weeks as well. Allman also has a series of YouTube videos where he is lecturing, and that's called The Gods of War. And that's an excellent little lecture, too. Yeah.
Well, maybe you could make the title a little more relevant by saying, whom would Peter or Paul kill? Or what branch of the service would they join? And I think your answer would have to be unquestionably uniform with anybody in this church, that they wouldn't do anything.
Okay. Yeah, that makes the question more immediately relevant. Who would, or which branch of the services would Peter or Paul join? Right. Anytime you pull up anachronistic questions, then you're butting up against some different things.
I mean, they use a lot of military metaphors. you know, they talk about the Bible being a sword or an assault rifle in today's parlay.
You know, and I think it's going to be helpful for us to look at some of those questions. Last week, Ken, you brought up a question which caught me flat-footed. As a person trained in philosophy, you know, I should be the first one plumping for definitions, and I just felt foolish to not have come up with a definition of war before I got going on my class on just war. And so I'm grateful to Ken for the question, and I'm grateful to Allman for the definition that he gives us, which I think it's after a discussion which includes Orend and Clausewitz, and he writes, and Walzer, "We define war as the freely chosen use of physical and usually deadly force by one political community against another political community to compel the latter to submit to a social, political, economic, or ideological objective." So that has some of the characteristics of a definition that we might want. It's dry. It's a little boring. Yeah?
And it broadens the issue so widely it can almost be useless.
Now everything's war.
Because everything's war now. Because traditionally war was interstate violence undertaken by official agents of state. Now you're talking about political communities. You're talking about national ethnicity groups within a country who might use, you know, cutting off access to some other group's water as a kind of warfare. So
right. Right. I don't yet see why we would not want to adopt Allman's definition. I realize that it does broaden things considerably, so that even intertribal warfare in Papua New Guinea might qualify. Well, he is qualifying it by saying physical and usually deadly force. So, you know, I think all definitions are problematic, provisional, and we'll have to just sort of work within it for now, and perhaps as our discussion continues, we'll be able to refine it. Oh, no, not at all. I'm not easily offended, so if you've got something to shout out, I'd love to hear it. Yes?
Scripturally speaking, how would we stated this definition, but looking through the Bible and compare it to what God would say, you see where I'm headed here?
Yeah. Okay. And I think that the Bible may not be easily confined in order to give us a definition of war, but I think to have a more complete set of definitions, we should ask for a definition of peace as well, and there I think the Bible is going to be helpful to us. In the Bible, we frequently see peace. Well, you know, we've got the Jewish idea of peace, which is not shalom, is not just the absence of fighting, but it's more of a sense of well-being, from what I understand, and I don't understand much, but something more along the lines of a Greek eudaimonia of well-being. And I was struck last week Rob was preaching from Zechariah 3, and you've got this vision. And in Zechariah 3, verse 9, "For behold, on the stone that I have set before Joshua, on a single stone with seven eyes, I will engrave its inscription, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of the land in a single day. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to come under his vine and under his fig tree." To me, what's interesting there is you get at least two of this little threefold aspect of peace. Peace and justice and righteousness are frequently appearing together in the Bible. And to me, it's interesting that the precondition for peace is not what my American triumphalistic mindset might be, which is to say, peace is what happens when we're more powerful than everyone else. Which is sort of, I think, what my knee-jerk natural idea is. But peace is what happens when there's righteousness. So we've got, I will remove the iniquity of this land in a single day. Okay, total sanctification. And what's the result of that? Well, every one of you will invite his neighbor to come under his vine and under his fig tree, right? Not the word peace, but clearly an image of shalom, and a very striking one at that. Right. And so the in an eschatological perspective, our final peace is secured, not by accident, at the same time that righteousness begins to reign perfectly. I think that's really interesting, because I don't think that from a human perspective I would associate the idea of peace as being a consequent of righteousness, or that righteousness is a precondition for true peace. In Allman's book, we've got, there's a number of reasons I love him, right? Because for one thing, he answers Ken Foyt's question and gives a definition of war. Maybe it's not an adequate definition, but at least he's trying. Another thing he does is he actually puts a chart here, pacifism to the left, holy war to the right, just war in the middle. And he's got a taxonomy trying to lay out some of the different forms of pacifism. And on the absolute far left, you've got absolute pacifism, and then universal, principle, classical, and strategic pacifism. Moving to the right from there. And I'd like to do a fair amount of reading from his book and talk a little bit about some of the history, especially the early Christian witness. So the church fathers are, for the most part, pretty strongly pacifistic in the way they're writing and speaking. The idea seems to be that if you're a Christian, of course, you're not going to be a soldier. And that's a pretty interesting consideration. We don't usually just dismiss the church fathers lightly. We usually have some pretty good reason if we're not going to agree with them on something. And the story that a lot of just war theorists might say in reply is, well, look, they didn't join the Roman army because, look, the Roman army was pagan. They're making sacrifices to idols. You know, the emperor himself, for crying out loud, is a god. So of course they can't serve in the army because it would require idolatry. And so that's what a just war theorist might say. The pacifist might say, right, but the reasons they were giving don't seem to major on that particular issue. They seem to have a more generalized condemnation of the use of force. And suspiciously, the transition, right, because you've got this historical transition, the transition from a seemingly pacifistic Christianity to a just war Christianity seems to very suspiciously take place right about when we get mainstream in, and we, you know, the time of Constantine, and we have a Christian state. And so that seems to be an issue. Now, I'm just giving you the broad gloss, a real quick and dirty, and I don't think it's as simple as that. And one of the places to notice that it's probably not as simple as that is Roland Bainton's History, Christian Attitudes Toward War and Peace. And he helps us complicate that picture and notice that we can't just get away with something that simple. But I think it's important to just sort of notice that that's sort of one of the exchanges that takes place. If I can pause, or if I can continue before I take additional comment, I'm just going to talk through Allman's book a little bit. I do hope some or many of you will buy it. If I had to recommend just a single text, it would be this one, in spite of my chagrin at the title. One of the first things that he points out is that pacifism is not the same as passivism. That's a homonym, and that's to be completely inactive, right? But you have examples like Gandhi who are pacifistic. They're certainly not passive, right? So interesting distinction, and hard to hear, easy to see on the page. He starts by pointing out, look, there's a cycle of violence. If you've got violence or humiliation, perhaps, may precede violence, and then you've got violence, and then more humiliation, and then retaliation. And so you have this ongoing spiral of violence. And this is something that you can read about in ancient Greek tragedy. You can read about it in any history book. And it's clearly the problem. How do you break cycles of violence? Once they begin, there's only seemingly the probability that things will get worse. There's rarely the opportunity to make things better unless at some point someone says, okay, let's not return evil for evil. So in his taxonomy, there's absolute pacifism, universal pacifism. Maybe I'd better say a word about each. Typically, the religiously based pacifists are absolute. So maybe Gandhi, Tolstoy, Martin Luther King are some of the examples he lists. Although, since their methods provoked their opponents to use force and their efforts were supported by others who used some forms of coercion, sometimes they don't even make the grade on absolute pacifism. I think absolute pacifism is one of the easiest things for us to dismiss. Rightly or wrongly, I think we do dismiss it. Universal pacifism is to say that the rejection of violence is a universal value applying to everyone, everywhere, and not just to particular individuals or communities. Principled pacifism is motivated out of a commitment to peace and a rejection of violence. Like absolute pacifism, it does not consider context or consequences as relevant. Instead, one is committed to the principle of peacemaking. Principled pacifism differs from absolute pacifism in that it is not based on an objective claim that violence is inherently wrong. Rather, it rejects violence out of a personal motivation or communal commitment, allowing for exceptions in limited situations. For principled pacifists, this commitment to peace and nonviolence is a personal choice, a commitment of the individual, and that would be particular pacifism, or a smaller group, maybe communal pacifism. And although principled pacifists reject violence, they do not judge others who resort to violence, for example, police officers and soldiers. So they don't reject them as inherently wrong or immoral. Principled pacifism also includes people whose vocation or profession is based on nonviolence, for example, clergy and physicians and humanitarian aid workers. Principled pacifists therefore can claim, I or we believe that violence is wrong, but we accept the right of others to use force as the state or those responsible for protecting the common good. What's going to be the criticism of principled pacifism that springs most easily to mind?
Well, I was thinking when you were reading all that, John, that we live in the heart of peacemakerism down there in Olympia.
Okay, yeah.
And I was thinking when you were talking about all that side of the spectrum, boy, doesn't sometimes even peace start to be a euphemism for a lot of things that are actually normally wrong? On the, just like war could be too. I mean, peace at all costs, peace is a, you know, nothing is inherently wrong.
Okay. Right. I think you're bringing up an interesting problem, and that is there may be people who hold that perspective. They might be pro-peace in a way where it's a part of a larger worldview that which includes other un-Christian or anti-Christian viewpoints. I think for our purposes, we don't have to worry too much that there are people like that. We're interested in how intellectually serious of a case there is for pacifism, and we're probably not going to find it with those people. We certainly are not in their camp. There are intellectually serious Christian voices within the pro-peace pacifist movement. And so I think it's going to be our job to just focus on them and sort of shrug and say, you know, there's also, you know, people who agree with us on all sorts of other things that we might just say, but they're complete goofballs, right? And, you know, this happens in politics. Maybe you're voting for a particular candidate and there's some goofball who's for that same candidate. you don't really want to put that person up as the poster boy for your cause, right? Yeah.
In Ecclesiastes, in the third chapter, it says, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. And in the last verse of that section, it says, the time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace.
Right.
And in our confession of faith, it says that the magistrate, they may lawfully, now under the New Testament, wage war upon just and necessary things.
Right.
What I read before that was God's word.
Right.
I think I don't know where you're going with this because I got kind of late in this, but I'm a military veteran. I'm a retired Army enlisted person, and so I have viewpoints of war. I was in Vietnam, and so I have definite viewpoints of war and of peace.
Right.
And I've seen both the ROTC building at the University of Oregon bombed by peaceful activists.
Right. So they don't qualify on the absolute.
And Vietnam veterans against the war.
Right.
And listened to what they had to say, and I was a part of that war. But I think you have to understand what is a just war. And I don't know where you're going with all this, but I think that to me is what is a just war.
Right. And so I think we'll, you know, if we're looking at the whole spectrum, I think we do have serious Christian voices to listen to from the pacifist perspective and the just war perspective in particular. I'm actually running short on serious Christian voices that are on the total war perspective or the realist perspective. I don't know of any serious, what I would call a serious Christian ethical voice in that perspective. That I certainly think we can find people who articulate that, but they're not doing the project of serious ethics, I don't think. So, you know, in response, I guess I would just ask for you to hear us out, and we'll discuss, you know, what is the pacifist saying? What is his motivation? What is he, you know, he's not ignoring Ecclesiastes. He may have his own proof texts for his perspective as well. And so, but I think it is going to be important for us to listen to them and hear the whole story. Yeah. I don't think you did maybe hear me correctly.
Okay. You turn them off at the end. I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I was trying to simply make the point that in the Bible we see peace with justice and righteousness, and those three things tend to come together as a package deal.
That is what you're saying.
Right.
You said you don't personally have always thought
of it. Well, I hadn't. I hadn't thought of it that way. I might be more inclined to think of it in another way, but I think the Bible's corrective there is to say, look, real peace is a product of righteousness and justice.
So in the terms of peace versus war, war where there's active hostility, peace where there's none, that doesn't kind of an absolute. What about in the does our language limit us to just war and peace, or is there a truce in between, or is it still?
Yeah, so I'm just trying to add some definitions to get us started. We're going to start with Allman's definition of war. Certainly, there's everything in between. I don't think we yet have seen peace, maybe except for the Garden of Eden. But since the Garden of Eden, we haven't seen true shalom. And we're not going to see it again until the eschaton, probably. So we're stuck in the middle until then. Let me push on a little bit, if I may. And I think what I wanted to point out about pacifism is that one of the most obvious criticisms of it, at least in my mind, is, look, that's just simply not going to work, right? If you don't resist evil at all, it's just going to run you over and it's not going to think twice about it. So that even if I were to do that in the home, if I've got a homebreaker, if I don't resist him at all sorts of bad things might happen to me or my family or my stuff. And so it's impractical. I think that's probably the placeholder in a lot of people's mind as a refutation of pacifism. And I think that has some validity to it. But I think it may be problematic as a final answer for a Christian, because in the ethical terms, that's described as consequentialism. You're determining what's right and wrong depending on the consequence. And that's typically not our territory. Consequentialism is not, because it's there's frequently reasons for us to do something that's not necessarily in our best interest, right? So if we were, as Christians, if we were consistent consequentialists, it's not at all clear we would be able to have a Christian martyr, right? How would a Christian martyr ever choose to put themselves at risk and to finally die standing up for the gospel, right? That's not a consequentialist ethic. We don't obey God because it gets us what we want or even what we need. And yet, at the same time, we're also frequently rewarded with good consequences by a God who's designed the world in as a moral theater in which frequently the righteous don't lack bread, right? Frequently they don't. The Bible goes on and says something even stronger than that in hyperbole, but we don't take that to be, we don't want to say that, okay, no one who's righteous is ever going to lack bread. Probably we don't want to do that because, you know, there's probably righteous people in Sudan who did end up dying for lack of bread, and maybe partially because of their righteousness. So the consequentialism aspect is a problem. I don't think that can be our only critique of pacifism. There does need to be other critiques of it, and we'll get to some of those. Let me get into Almond's description of pacifism and scripture. He notices that the Hebrew word for peace is shalom, and peace is primarily seen as a gift of God, the fruit of living in right relationship with God. And so when the Israelites throughout the Old Testament are in right relationship with God and with one another, God promises peace. For example, in Ezekiel 37, I will make with them a covenant of peace. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will multiply them and put my sanctuary among them forever. My dwelling shall be with them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. But when Israel fails to observe the terms of God's covenant, God also threatens. For example, in Leviticus 26, but if you do not heed me and do not keep all these commandments, if you reject my precepts and spurn my decrees, refusing to obey all of my commandments and breaking my covenant, then I will give you your deserts. You will sow your seed in vain, for your enemy will consume the crop. I will turn against you till you are beaten down by your enemies and lorded over by your foes. I will make the sword, the avenger of my covenant, sweep over you. And then we have the eschatological vision, for example, in Isaiah 11. Then the wolf shall be the guest of the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion shall browse together with a little child to guide them. The cow and the bear shall be neighbors together, their young shall rest, the lion shall eat hay like the ox. The baby shall play by the cobra's den, and the child lay his hand on the adder's lair. There shall be no harm or ruin on all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, as waters cover the sea. There's other places, obviously, where you can draw from the eschatological. Well, there's a, I guess my idea for discussing pacifism is to confront and listen to the most serious voices of Christian ethical reasoning. And so I don't think many of us are pacifists, but I do think that their ideas about justice and war and their investigations into what the Scripture says and how they interpret Scripture is going to help us deepen our understanding, even if we think in the final analysis that they're incorrect and that just war theory is correct. I think it's important for us to listen to them and hear them out. I take that to be a good exercise with all sorts of positions that I disagree with. And part of that is maybe from a philosophy perspective, you know, I take it to be my job to understand the atheist's argument as well as they know it, and then to be able to respond. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, pacifism is the equivalent of atheism. I'm just trying to say that there's a something to be learned from every voice. Yeah. Okay.
We may or may not have much influence on what that state's going to, how the state's going to decide things. So we, to the question earlier, yeah, we do have a lot of problems, seems to me. Not that's not your problem, we all have it. But that, as you're saying that, I think these passages so far seems like a personal level discussion. How will I undertake my own spiritual expression of what I think about violence? The state may do whatever it wants, irrespective of whatever I say. Has yet to listen to me. So that seems what in the political science, this is what you call levels analysis problem. Furthermore, I had a really great point that was probably and the whole thing is gone.
Oh, yeah. Well.
You'll come back to you by next week. Right?
Yeah. And I, you know, clearly there are different levels of analysis. Whether or not we are in a position to speak to power and whether or not the power is likely to listen to us, I think it's interesting. I think as Christians, if our government is doing something that we disagree with, then it is our role to stand up and speak a voice out loud and to say, but. So, and we effectively do that with abortion, for example, by standing outside the clinic, by agitating for legislation which would limit things like that. And then at a personal ethical level, we don't do abortion, right? Right. I think I'm a little uncomfortable with the way you phrase that, just because I think our responsibility as Christians is to be ethically wise to our time, so that even if we disagree with our government and our government doesn't give a fig for our opinion, that it's still our responsibility to have an informed opinion and whenever we can to speak up for it. It may end up affecting choices as, for example, whether or not we or our children end up serving in the military or under what conditions they might serve in the military. So I think that's, you know, different levels of analyses. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I completely agree with Andrew's comments that definitions are so challenging and difficult. And when we say, let's discuss just war, what you're really saying is let's develop a normative Christian ethic. But it isn't really even that, because it's a normative Christian political ethic, since war itself is defined by this, Clausewitz and others, as political things. But is it possible to do that? And I say it absolutely is not possible to do that. And Scripture itself tells you. For instance, when Jerusalem was invaded by the Babylonians, the cry of Jeremiah was, this is not a self-defense issue. Lay down your arms, open up, and give in to the invader. Mm-hmm. Okay? There is no normative ethic there that we can develop. And so any talk about just war, if we assume it to be some sort of a normative ethic that we're going to hold for all time, for all circumstances, we just aren't going to do it.
Okay, so, and I don't, I guess I'm not sure that you're describing my project, so I might simply agree with you that describing a single just war ethic and outlining it in a neat and tidy way and saying, there it is, it's all wrapped up, ready to put under the tree. When you need it, you can pull it out. I think it's much more complicated than that. I think everybody that I'm reading would agree that it's more complicated than that. And, you know, part of our indication is that it's so complicated that after 45 minutes of discussion, we haven't solved all the issues quite yet. You know, albeit Andrew was threatening. So next week we'll continue to investigate the pacifist perspective.